Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Friday, September 15th, 2023. We are now in the middle of September and coming to the end of the third quarter. It's an interesting time, the beginning of fall, and of course, usually Fridays are slow news days, but today is not a slow news day, so I'm going to be pushing my my agenda here a little bit quickly. So thank you very much for tuning in to the Eastman Financial Report, WVW-TV. As you know, we are certainly we're not a commercial network, we're a sponsored network, and the people like viewers, kind viewers like you and other sponsors generously keep these programming on the air, and we're very thankful for that because it gives us a chance to express viewpoints and alternative viewpoints, and there's no paywall or there's no subscription. You're able to tune in and watch and enjoy our programming, and it stimulates thinking, and it's all good. Anyway, I want to thank my sponsor today, Swiss America Trading. Of course, as you know, they've been a great sponsor for this program and the network in general. And you know what they say, every dark cloud is a silver lining, right? Well, today, I'm going to prove this to you. What you see, the rising political and economic uncertainties that I talk about every day, it's increasing market volatility. And as a reaction to that, gold and silver prices have been up. And Swiss America is a very good dealer in precious metals. And they're offering my viewers a spectacular deal. There's an introductory offer where they're offering silver walking Liberty half dollars. These are those bullion coins I was talking about. Well, if you want to get a really good deal on those, they're offering these things at the amazing price of just $13.50 each. And that includes shipping. So it's, you know, $13.50 delivered. That's an amazing price. So it's, you know, $13.50 each. Now there's a limit of 250 of these coins per customer. So you know, you might want to act quickly if you want to get yourself, you know, take advantage of this offer, because it's only while supplies last. So if you're interested in, you know, in adding to your individual portfolio and you want to add some tangible precious metals, give them a call at 800-519-6271. Go to the website, SwissAmerica.com, use the promo code EASTMAN for Eastman Financial Report, and they'll be happy to either send you some free information, or, you know, basically they'll sell you some coins at a really good price. This price isn't going to last forever, and the reason is because gold is very, and silver is very, very volatile. So give them a call today. It's a great deal, Silver Walking Liberty half dollars. Go to the website. You can look up and see what that looks like and what it means, and at $13.50 each, all included, including shipping. That's a super deal. So take advantage of their offer if you're interested in that market. Okay, I want to move into the news rather quickly today. Speaking of precious metals, there's a great story reported yesterday that I forgot to mention, right? I didn't get to it, but I'm watching the Japanese economy. You say, well, why would you do that? You live in Wisconsin. Who cares about Japan? Well, the world does. Japan's a very important country, a very big economy, and it's a very high quality place. I mean, Japan, with respect to manufacturing and banking and financials and electronics, you know, they're the best of the best. And frankly, what happens in Japan is important. And Japan has had a problem with an aging population. And their federal budget is very much like the United States. They spend vastly more money on social services and government services than they take in income taxes. But unlike the United States, Japan kind of threw the barn door open about 20 years ago with quantitative easing, and their budget deficits are larger than the United States per capita. So, in gross dollars or yen, but they've got huge deficits. And what's happening in Japan is that the people are beginning to understand that the federal government over there has basically spent itself into oblivion, and the people are reacting by buying gold. And which is very interesting, because the Japanese are very, very conservative people, and they don't react quickly to anything. The Japanese culture is not a culture of panic. It's a culture of long-term thinking. You know, they open up a company and they think about, what does our company look like 150 years from now? I mean, that's a classic trait of the Japanese, is this patient and very forward-looking, long-thinking people, which has produced astounding wealth for the Japanese. So when you see that the average Japanese person is starting to run to the coin shops and buying gold, and is running the price of gold up tremendously in yen, what they're sensing is the same problem that we're sensing in America. These federal governments are spending way beyond, you know, they're driving past their headlights. They're spending way beyond their capacity to tax the public. So what people in Japan are doing is turning their yen into gold, and I'm assuming silver as well. So you might want to be thinking about that. And that's why when an offer from, you know, Swiss America comes along at $13.50 for a standing half dollar, that's a bullion quality coin. You may want to be thinking about your friends and neighbors in Japan and, you know, whether that makes sense for you as well. Because one thing precious metals do, gold and silver, is hold the value. And it's not because the coins are going up in price. It's because the 1 ounce or whatever is, it takes more yen or more dollars to buy the same piece of metal. So as your economy is blown off into an inflationary cyclone, you have to capture the buying power of those dollars. And that's a way to do it when you invest in precious metals. And of course, there are all sorts of financial instruments that you can do that, but there's nothing better to hold a tangible piece of precious metal in your very hands or stuff it in your sock drawer rather than in some ETF sock drawer somewhere where you hope there's a sock drawer. So give Swiss America a call, 1-800-519-6271, or go to their website, do a little research. But hey, they're running a great special today, so sign up. Okay, I want to talk about the biggest news story of the day, which is historic, actually. The United Auto Workers, which represents auto workers around the country, has gone on strike. I was going to say striked or stricken, but they have gone on strike, and they are having strikes at all three of the big Detroit manufacturers, which of course is Ford and General Motors and Stellantis, which is kind of a fancy new way to say Chrysler. It's the Jeep plants, but the reality is that Stellantis is really Fiat, who bought Chrysler, and the Fiat is an Italian company. They own Chrysler, and then they bought and merged with the Peugeot of France. So it's like the fourth largest automaker in the world. And the point is the United Auto Workers are striking that. And of course, when you look at why, the wages of the average auto worker, there's a two-tiered system that was put in place quite a while back. And it basically pays the top tier workers big salary, $33 an hour plus benefits and this and that. And the lower tier workers, the newer workers, they're paid like $28 an hour and the benefits aren't as good. So all of this is rattling the doorknob of the labor movement. Now, 94% of Americans are not in a union, but the 6% who are, that matter. And this is 150,000 production workers in these auto plants. And when they go on strike, production stops. And of course, Ford and GM and you know, the Stellantis, their earnings, when you look at revenues minus expenses as earnings, you know, the union says, you guys are making too much money and we need some. And the company says, oh, if we do this, we'll go broke. It's the typical labor negotiations, and they're going to argue, they're going to fight. And the longer they're out on strike, the worse it is for the company's, you know, basically income statement and balance sheet. And then we hope that this comes to an amicable end so that these three automakers don't end up like Yellow Truck, where they're out of business and the union guys are out of jobs. So we'll watch that. But it's historic in that they they went on strike at all three at the same time. Usually the UAW will target one company, and you know, it's usually the one with the highest profits, and they go for it. Well, this is sending a general signal. And if you listen to my lectures this week, you're seeing that you know, the three silos, you got the poor, the middle, and then the rich, and that middle class is feeling the squeeze, and that's why they're striking. And of course, that's the purpose of a union, is to represent the workers. And the most important thing to workers is, how much do I make an hour, and my benefit package, and perhaps a pension retirement package. I mean, those are and worker safety as well. I mean, they want to be working in a safe environment. So there are multiple issues that are negotiated. And when you see the union taking an aggressive stance after 9% inflation last year and 3.7% inflation this year, this is predictable. It was predictable all through the 1970s when inflation was big, everybody's going on strike and everything. It's the same phenomenon today. So we'll be watching this. And of course, this will be in the news, and hopefully they'll come to an amicable settlement. The push for automotive transformation with this electric car thing, this is a huge, huge capital expenditure to retool to start making electric cars at the very same time that your labor, the cost push function of labor, the demand for more pay because of inflation, it's costing more to live. These are not good times for corporate management because you're trying to deal with not only labor demands in an inflationary environment, but you have this transformational technology costing huge capital and engineering. And frankly, whenever a new technology comes into place, the first couple of iterations aren't really that good, So they're going to be struggling with the technology as well as the cost. So we'll be paying attention to that. Hopefully the car companies will survive or we'll all be back to riding horses, but I think we're probably okay for now. Okay, I want to also talk about another phenomenon, and this is, like I said, there's a lot of news today. If you remember back in the day when I started this program, I think it was in March, the first week of March, we launched the Eastman Financial Report. And the purpose of this report, of course, is to look past the financial headlines, and the headlines are designed to trigger reaction. In all newspapers, you see a headline, and dog bites man, and then you want to read the story. But at the end of the day, most people read the headlines, but they don't delve into the text. And quite frankly, while there are many great reporters in the world, financial reporting and technical reporting is more complex. It's not auto accident on 4th and Main. It's talking about very complex financial structures. So you want to be able to think past the headline and get into the story and think about what does this exactly mean, And that's what we've been doing. So back when I started in March, there were kind of two things going on. There was the government is going to shut down because we've bumped up against the debt ceiling, and Janet Yellen, our Treasury Secretary, was saying, I can't sell any more debt because we're up against the debt limit, but I need money to pay the bills. So if I can't sell more debt, and we can't necessarily squeeze the taxpayers because it's a one-year cycle, you pay your taxes on April 15th, we're going to go broke, see, or we're going to shut down. So that was a big political story. We were watching the news every week, and McCarthy, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, introduced a bill that said, well, we're going to raise the debt ceiling 1.5 million, or excuse me, $1 trillion, which at this point, 6 months later, seems quaint. 1.5, and of course, Chuck Schumer over in the Senate voted no. Chuck Schumer, who nobody around here ever voted for, voted no, and or signaled no. And then, of course, the president said, no, we're not doing that. And they ended up suspending the debt ceiling and averted the crisis of a government shutdown. Remember that? It was, oh, the government's going to shut down. And all the conservatives are saying, good, we don't need a government. And everybody else is like, well, that would be inconvenient and we're going to fly, or let's find a solution. So they did. They found a solution and the government didn't shut down. Okay, it was back in February, March. Well, here we are, 6 months later, headline, government will shut down September 30th if Congress doesn't act. Well, this was 6 months ago. So now we're in a cycle where every 6 months the federal government's going to shut down. Well, hit the debt ceiling, we've got to shut down. Well, now we are basically we're out of money and we can't start spending in the next fiscal year unless you pass some bills. And basically what's happening is we're going to hear that the federal government's going to shut down on September 30th unless somebody does something. So this is going to be 6 months later, we're going to hear the same thing. And then the question is, from a business perspective, is if you ran your business where every 6 months you were in imminent danger of going broke and having to shut down, you probably should just think about shutting down because you're not running your operation correctly. I mean, most business, all businesses, even the push cart or the with the cigar box for the coins, you have a budget. And if you don't stick to your budget as closely as you can, you are in uncharted waters, and the likelihood of you going broke is significant. Everybody has a budget. The municipal community I live in has an annual budget. My county has an annual budget. my state has an annual budget, and those budgets cannot be in deficit according to the United States Constitution, which was, that concept was stretched a little bit with California. But the theory is all of the local governments and the state governments are on a paper budget. They write them out, and there's a balanced budget. And of course, if you operate your government correctly, you're going to have a little surplus at the end of your year. You're not going to spend it all, okay? Because you need a little rainy day fund. And most local budgets budget for that. So they have a reserve in case there's a big snowstorm and you gotta dig everybody out, or maybe, you know, a bridge collapses or a tornado comes through and blows half the town away. You need to have a little reserve, and you have to operate your government within a budget. Just like the guy who owns the gas station and the lady who owns the grocery store and the insurance agent down the road. Everybody's got a budget. And if you have any sense of fiscal sanity, you operate within a budget so you don't go broke. And the people who don't, well, they go broke. Well, that doesn't seem to apply to the federal government in the United States. And it's remarkable that there is absolutely no mechanism in Congress that allows for the tradition of perhaps the president issuing a budget, sending it to Congress. Congress nitpicks it away and they tweak it, and there's a big negotiation. And maybe the Congress, because remember, the House of Representatives holds the purse strings. So maybe they put a budget together and they hand it to the president and they say, you know, Mr. President, Mrs. President, you know, you're going to have to, you know, here's your budget for the next year. Go ahead and run the government. That's what they elected you to do. None of that happens. It used to happen back in the day. But with this idea of Keynesian economics, which is not only tax and spend, but tax, borrow, and spend, it has broken out of the box. And now here we are again, and this is going to be a big story. No sooner do all the congressional people fly home to the districts, and now we've got this big story that defense appropriations, there's no budget to live on, and, you know, basically, there's a 60% chance, some news outlets are reporting a 60% chance that the government will shut down in 2 weeks, because effectively the federal year, the fiscal year for the federal government runs October 1st through September 30th. And of course, this is September 15th. So here it is, 2 weeks before the end of the fiscal year. And Congress has to approve appropriations because they don't have a budget. So there's the finance, Department of Finance appropriation, and there's all the other federal things, Department of Defense appropriations, and all the other agencies. And without these appropriations, poor old Janet Yellen can't spend any money because she doesn't have an approved budget. And they have to have these you know, either continuing resolutions, which is sort of like kick the can down the road a little bit, or these appropriation bills. And of course, they're playing the game. So now, once again, we are distracted by this phenomenon in Washington that the very people that have the ability to tax 35-40% of our income and supposedly spend it for the public good now find that they can't manage that process. The executive isn't leading, and this isn't just this executive. This goes all the way back. I mean, it's just since the 60s and the evolution of the Keynesian model. It is, there's just a simple thought in Washington that they have to spend money on every last program. And if they don't, you know, somehow it's a political problem. But the reality is the American tax base can't support the spending. And that's why you see this gross, national debt increasing, you know, $32 trillion, $34 trillion, pick a number, who knows. So it's a very interesting thing. But the news story that I was reading, it was quite surprising that if the government were to shut down, whatever that means, is a tenth of a percent. It's 0.1% of our gross domestic product every week. That's how much government spending would apparently not happen if they're not allowed to spend as of October 1st. And that becomes a real eye-opener because, you know, when you think about national income, I talk about national income or gross domestic product or gross national product, GDP, that's all the money in the economy from the private sector. What we earn, businesses earn, that's the whole economy. And, you know, it's a tenth of a percent per week is the federal government, which is, you know, still relatively small, but it's that's that tax and spend, borrow and spend component. So effectively, we're going to watch this, and of course, next week is going to, the story will be, you know, hotter, and of course, you know, Schumer is already throwing rotten apples at the House, and the House is busy with all of its political stuff. And at the end of the day, we shall see. We're just going to have to see what happens. But the thing that is being noticed by more and more people is that the federal government just simply is not administering the people's fisc at any sense of responsibility. If this was a corporation, that company would have been broke decades ago. So, you know, when your congressional representative comes around sending you the old fundraising letters, you know, or a village hall meeting, or a village, you know, like town hall meetings, it's really would be a good time to go and, you know, ask the question, hey, how come we're broke all the time? How come the government shuts down every 6 months? You know, because they're running around the globe spending money like crazy, but yet, you know, you don't collect enough. And when with the money you do collect, you have to borrow to subsidize the gap, and that's our national debt. It's getting to the point where the tax revenues collected at some point are going to equal the debt service. So I don't know how they're going to pay for everything else. This needs to be addressed. So anyway, that's a story very much worth watching. I did notice another interesting story that I think was sort of something that I said last week, so it was nice to either find my news. Don't think just because you're watching a small financial program that you're not getting the cutting edge. You are, because oftentimes I seem to the next day read what I said the day before in the news. But there's an interesting story talking about some views in Washington with respect to the Federal Open Market Committee of the Federal Reserve. Remember, their job is to try to regulate the economy, the velocity of the economy, by fiddling with the interest rates. That's monetary policy trying to regulate fiscal policy or national income. And it's an indirect or derivative tool, because raising the interest rates takes a while to trickle through the economy and slow it down. And that's all that they can do with monetary authority, is shut off the supply of credit or make credit more expensive. So in an economy that didn't live on credit, it was just the money in the economy and it would circulate all around, you wouldn't have this ability. You would not be able to raise interest rates to slow the velocity. And there's some argument in the Austrian school of thought that there shouldn't be credit within the economy. There should be money within the economy. And basically, there would be a regulatory mechanism where you would add and subtract money, sort of like the Fed's open market system, that would allow the economy to expand and contract by putting dollars in, pulling dollars out. And this goes right back to Milton Friedman and the monetarists, that this idea of fiddling around with the interest rates is an indirect way of getting to the goal. Well, the story was that some people are seeing the rise in gasoline prices as a more effective tool to regulate the economy, because when gas and diesel prices go up, the economy feels it instantly. When you go to the gas station and fill up and it costs you, you know, instead of $65 to fill your tank, it's $85, you feel it that day. So the theory is that if you can regulate the economy through the cost of fuel and transportation, that happens faster. Then you wouldn't have to worry about fiddling around with the money supply, and it's very esoteric, and only PhD economists have any idea what that's all about. So the thought is using gasoline to pull the punch bowl back, rather than raising interest rates to pull the punch bowl back. So the question is, how do you suppress an economy? Well, when you look at the national income, the big circle, there is so much energy involved in driving a modern economy that there's some, you know, theoretical idea that you could use the price of gasoline and diesel fuel to effectively stimulate the economy or you know, slow it down. And I think, you know, it's an interesting thought. And I think I alluded to that earlier this week, that, you know, gas and diesel prices are trickling through the economy and are having a real suppressing effect. And then I asked the question, is monetary policy and interest rate policy as effective in slowing the, or in bumping the economy as more direct inputs. So that was a very interesting story. And I think, we'll see where that plays out. It's theoretical at this point. But, the sad thing is, when if they jack up the price of gas to $7, yeah, the economy collapses. But what does it do to the people? And how about just leave the economy alone and the economy will kind of do its thing, and maybe people in Washington don't have to worry about, 2% inflation when they're pumping $34 trillion in debt into the system and then standing back aghast wondering why inflation rates are so high. We should just ask the Japanese. They did exactly the same thing. And what are you seeing in Japan right now is that people are scrambling out of yen and trying to buy more and more gold and silver tangibles because they know that that type of, cyclical behavior by the government ultimately ends up in a massive inflation. So by fiddling around with, by fiddling around with the interest rates, you may be using the wrong tool. But if you fiddle around with the gasoline prices, you're going to have 330 million Americans rather steamed at the federal government. So this is an interesting time in our history. But I was very interested to see that my story somehow, or at least my analytics, have made it into mainstream thought, which is flattering. So anyway, I also noticed another story, running out of time here, lots of news, that home contract, when people buy a home, they sign an offer to purchase or a sales contract, the buyer and the seller. And those contracts always have contingencies. My duty to close on this property transaction is contingent upon my ability to get a mortgage or my ability to approve an inspection in case the roof leaks. Those are called contingencies, and the buyers will make an offer, but there are contingencies, contingent upon me getting financing at a price I can afford. And what the story is that 16% right now of these home contracts are failing. Because they're being canceled by the buyer because they have these contingencies where they can get out. And it's because the financing costs are becoming so high. It's not only the 7.5% interest, 30-year mortgage, but it's, there are fees involved, the property taxes. And believe me, in inflationary times, property taxes go up. House insurance is going up tremendously, not only because of the hurricanes and wildfires, but just in general. So you're seeing 16% of houses that go under contract, the buyers are backing out. And that's why, it's not another good sign that housing is not robust. So we ask ourselves the question, if interest rates are back to 2%, the Feds would cut it back to 2%, and the housing market picks up, would that have an inflationary effect where people would just buy houses and run prices up, or would they start to regenerate life in the mortgage industry and home selling so that they can, you can get houses selling again, people can start moving around. And that's why playing games with this idea of raising the interest rates, that may have worked, and though it really never did, but you could say it may have worked in the olden days. I'm not sure when the olden days started or ended, but when you look at a modern economy that's got a massive debt overhang of 34 trillion, or pick a number, $34 trillion. Maybe fiddling with the interest rates is not good because it's costing the federal treasury more in interest. It's costing the banks, of course. The commercial real estate market's collapsing. Home ownership is stalled, all because they're trying to squeeze inflation down to 2% when they're the ones that trigger the inflation to begin with. One has to wonder. Speaking of inflation, of course, the University of Michigan inflation survey is out today. And when they sample the people, that's what they do. They call average people and they say, "Hey, what do you think about inflation?" And everybody's, "Well, I think it's coming down, you know." And then all of the indicators we're talking about are showing an increase in inflation at 3.7% that came out of the consumer price numbers. Core inflation is up. Every indicator is showing inflation increasing. And they're calling the average American, "Oh, yeah, I think the inflation's going down." There's a disconnect, and that's a big part of the problem with financial reporting. They see the headlines. Oh, inflation's down. Oh, okay. But the reality is, they're not understanding the deeper story. And that was an interesting little reveal today, that's an important indicator. Well, of course, I'm out of time, and have a great weekend. I will talk to you next Monday and give Swiss America a call and take advantage of that $13.50 price on those silver halves. That's a deal. So give them a call. Thanks so much. Bye.